Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
My next conversation, my next podcast is with Rick Wolf. He's kind of a hard guy to nail down in a way as well. He's got such an interesting eclectic background. He comes out of a theater background, a director of drama. He is an interesting guy with a huge amount of knowledge and a vast amount of experience in the advertising world. He's been teaching. He's traveled the world. It's crazy. But we talk a lot about what he says he stumbled into this, what he calls a kitchen table conversation. And I think you're going to want to listen very closely to some of the stuff that we get into. And one of the things Rick says is that, you know, we all have to stop having meetings and start having conversations. It seems to me that Rick is really fascinated to find out what actually is really going on in corporate cultures and in a variety of different settings anyway, and finding out how we can create a culture of openness and a culture of curiosity. And I think Rick would say that that happens through conversation. So listen in and listen up. I think you're going to really enjoy this interview for a whole lot of reasons, a lot of takeaways here, a lot of lessons learned, a lot of really interesting bits of business about dialogue and about, you know, how to make our conversations deeper, more intimate, and more meaningful, ultimately. Rick Wolf, poststone.com is the website. You'll learn more about that on the podcast as well. And don't forget to check out my site, davidpecklive.com, for more info on my podcasting, public speaking, and writing. Stay tuned for Rick Wolf. Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by, once again, another very special guest. And we are currently sitting in a Toronto office, a small boardroom at a hedge fund company, which I think is kind of interesting for a lot of reasons. But you know what? We're not here to talk about finances today, I don't think. Rick Wolf, who is a consultant and a conversationalist, is here with us today. He's our guest. Rick, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for inviting me.
So we're probably going to talk pretty specifically about some of the work that you actually do. But Rick and I met recently at a workshop, and he was interviewed, interestingly. And I was really kind of captivated by not only the content, I think, but also the approach that Rick took. And so a few days later, we touched base through email, and I was thrilled and delighted that you said yes to the interview. So thanks again for joining us today. I think the fact that you're a consultant and you're interested in conversation, nice alliteration, by the way, fascinates me for a lot of reasons. And I think it has to do with partially the fact that I do a bit of teaching. I've got a philosophical background. You know, how do we communicate ideas? How do we get things across to others? How do we penetrate those frameworks and the structures that seem to exclude others more often than not? So I'd love to hear
how do we get understood? How do we check to make sure that we are understanding?
So they actually are called kitchen table conversations. This is something you sell. It's on your website. You've written about it. You've over 1,000 of these things that you've done in a professional setting, and many, many more in an informal setting, I would think. Mm.
Where does the idea even come from?
I stumbled into it. And on the day I stumbled into it, I think I probably noticed it because kitchen table conversation had been part of my life since I was a toddler. My family has an incredibly lively kitchen table culture, and so that made me really attuned to its possibilities when in a business setting one day I participated in a meeting that was unlike any meeting I had ever been in and was way more fun and I thought tremendously fruitful. And so I just parked the thought and started to noodle on the idea of really deliberately building a practice with kitchen table conversation as the very foundation of the practice.
So your background is in branding, marketing, advertising, pretty high level, pretty high stress from what I understand. You were overseas, spent several years in Japan. It sounded, as you unpacked that for us at the workshop, when I got done a little bit more research on your background, sounded a little crazy to me. Sounded a little insane, actually, capital I.
There were certainly days that it felt insane. And I do have a background in marketing, and I did have the opportunity to work with some great global brands over the years, brands from Coca-Cola and American Express and Tiffany & Company and others along the way. But those are just three of the better-known brands that I worked with when I worked for an ad agency. I should also say that advertising wasn't my first stop along the way, but before working in advertising, I directed plays.
Right, drama, theater.
And when I started out in consulting, I didn't really notice that I was drawing heavily on that experience. Looking back, and it's looking back over 25 years, I now realize that my training and my mindset as a director of plays has had every bit as much influence on my work as a consultant as everything I learned in business and from great brands has influenced my work as well.
Do actors take direction well?
Most take direction very well, but not all take direction well. And it's really up to the director. It's up to the director to find the most elegant, respectful way of influencing or guiding the actor that he or she possibly can.
It's interesting the choice of words that you use. To me, Rick, it sort of gives me some insight into the conversational sort of approach that you take as a consultant and so on. Is direction, would you say, a form of constructive criticism?
Constructive criticism is one of the tasks of a director. A director is also a classic leader in the sense that a director must have a vivid vision of the show that he or she wants to put up on the stage. The playwright provides a passion and a path and a structure, but the playwright leaves out as much as is included, and it's up to the director and the actor and the designers and everybody else to fill in all the pieces that were left out by the playwright, and it's really the responsibility of the director, entirely the responsibility of the director, to have a vision for what's needed to fill in all the blanks left by the playwright.
Is that you're finding the common thread, or is it more than that? Is it
It is certainly finding the common thread. It's finding the beating heart. It's making it relevant to today's audience. It is incredibly unlikely that the best production of a play for the year 1800 would be the best production of that same play in the year 2016. That if somebody somehow from one era were to find themselves in the audience of the other era, there would be things that they recognize and things that they find incredibly weird and unsettling. And so the director's one of the director's job is to speak to today's audience. And when you're doing a classic play, sometimes I've done plays from the Greek era, it's over 2,000 years old, well over 2,000 years old. In those cases, your job is to bring forward the ideas and the feelings and the way people lived those millennia ago, at the same time as opening up for the audience what it is about that story that is meaningful today.
And why is this timeless, and why does it have something to say to us today?
Right.
I am blown away, and Oscar Wilde did not live that long ago, but blown away at his insightfulness and how present he still is, and his writing still is.
And if you were to read his contemporaries, they would feel like they were from another planet. There are very few of his contemporaries are playable today.
Is that right? Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
And that's the difference between a classic and a piece that does fine in its day, but can't carry forward.
I've seen most of Wilde's stuff. I remember one of my favorites was Shaw, about a 45-minute reading of The Ballad of Reading Gaol. And there was about 11 or 12 different actors on stage, and they all took little different pieces. And it was very minimalistic, you know, from a stage setup and lighting and so on. But boy, it was delightful, and just such a huge fan of Wilde's work. I think, a director, I mean, you got to know a little bit about everything, really, don't you?
You do, and you have to know a fair bit about the actor's craft, and you have to know a fair bit about the human heart. It's a difficult apprenticeship because you have to go through years of apprenticeship before you know whether you're any good at it.
How much time do you, and obviously I think I see links all over the place to what you're doing today, and how much time did you as a director spend hanging out with your actors? In other words, building trust, building that relationship before you got to the stage so you could say, hey, Bill, maybe we should approach this way. Because it seems to me that there has to be a fair amount of that going on. Or do the actors just kind of... I mean, I think you can give trust and you can earn it. Maybe a good actor just gives the director trust. But yeah, do tell.
First of all, I was young and callow. I hope that if I were directing today, I would do it with more elegance. And you hear stories of directors who have great compassion and great ability to be empathetic with the actors and build up a strong rapport. And you hear about extremely good directors who are just awful human beings.
Interesting.
Who are, in fact, on the edge of being abusive, and I suspect, sadly, that sometimes it goes over the edge of abusiveness, and it's disappointing that that theaters continue to hire directors like that, and they do it because of their track records. They do it
because
notwithstanding their awful behavior, they consistently make brilliant work, and that's a shame.
And there's something kind of paradoxical about that. Seems to me as well. How is it that somebody that can be so anti-relational in the environment from a structure perspective, or from, you know, the work behind the curtain, how does that come out in a way that audiences connect with and resonate with?
The paradox is that you can have, and that's a really important question. The paradox is that you can have enormous insight as an artist and enormous capability as an artist, greatness as an artist, without being a great human being at all. Because on occasion people create an open space for a great artist to do her work or his work, you're not getting the feedback that the rest of us get to tell us that we're out of line, and so these habits build up over time, and you find out way too late that the world thinks that you're an impossible person. And sometimes it comes crashing down because people finally get fed up with the completely unacceptable behavior that occasionally comes along with great artists. And happily, there are stories at the opposite end as well. The great musician Placido Domingo, he is a spectacular singer. He is a concert pianist, and he is also an orchestra conductor, which is extraordinary. To be able to perform at the top level in three different skill sets. It's all music, but those are three very different skill sets. And Domingo performs at the top level. And because I have close ties to the theater, and my wife, in fact, Has performed in the world of opera and musical theater as a professional for a long, long time. And because of those links, I've heard from someone in the room about what a wonderful, wonderful human being Domingo is. And so that's important to remember, too. It's not that that every artist is a spoiled child. It's that, sadly, some are.
Do you think corporate environments need an injection of conversation? And I bet you have definitions of, you know, good, better,
sure,
bad.
Sure. Well, I was worried that you were going to ask me if corporate environments need an injection of a spoiled child. And thank you for not asking that, because absolutely not. And we have ever that problem in the corporate environment, too, sadly. Does the corporate environment need an injection of more conversation? Absolutely. Meetings, the classic meeting or the facilitated meeting, both are effective. There are many thousands of facilitators who do outstanding work, and there are many thousands of teams and many thousands of leaders that do astounding work. And yet, I think it can be demonstrated that for some tasks and some environments, conversation is just better. If we were to use a metaphor, if we could use water with sand in it, or because we discovered a new filter and were able to use pure water, why wouldn't we use the pure water? And conversation is what we're when we have a meeting, conversation is what we're trying to have, and yet the all of the little buckets and dividers that are injected into a typical meeting stop us from having a real conversation.
Well, people don't come to work to have a conversation, right? I mean, 9 to 5, I get on the train at 7:35 and I don't have a conversation there, for heaven's right. sakes. I read my paper and I answer a few email. And I mean, I think to some degree, I don't know if you'd agree with this, but when I used to work in a way more sort of furniture-like office, you know, divisive environment, I can use a lot of more negative expressions and cynical words for that,
yes.
but anti-relational, there was this different ethic, it seems to me.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
that this is my 9 to 5, therefore I can behave in a particular way, or I can behave badly.
So
right.
So and so the kind of question that I would ask is, well, given that as soon as we leave that environment and return to our life, whether we're with our family or with our friends, we stop having meetings and start having conversations, and yet it's not that we stop being productive in our life. We do our most important things in our life. And the way we do it is in conversation. So my view is, well, why wouldn't we do that at work, too? And not only that, but I think that if you were to canvas the world and ask people which is more fun, a conversation or a meeting, I'm pretty sure that most people would say a conversation is more fun than a meeting. Why would we not want to have fun at work if we can?
If we can, yeah.
And what my collaborators and I have been able to demonstrate all these years is that it is incredibly easy to use conversation, real genuine conversation, with just enough structure surrounding it to have it be every bit as productive as a meeting in the average case, much more productive than a meeting in many cases, and fun all the time. Now, of course, there are topics which are not fun, and mm-hmm. to be honest, no one has ever asked me to tackle one of those topics, and by that I mean where there is really serious conflict. And so I can't comment as to whether or not we could use our kitchen table conversation in that setting. It would be an amazing experiment to try. And yes, there are also topics that must be handled by a meeting. To run through a project list, you can't have a conversation when you're running through a project list, for instance. And there are some very, very technical topics. So analyzing a balance sheet, you wouldn't do in a conversation. But with the exception of those kinds of incredibly structured, granularly structured topics, there is an infinite number of questions and goals that businesses
can you
have.
Can you give us a good example of something that pops up a lot for you? So apparently companies stay away from the really potentially volatile issues in the kitchen table conversations. But what's something that
in my experience?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
Although
they
have,
could benefit greatly, probably.
I have coached an arbitrator,
and
he was intrigued by the potential of kitchen table conversation in his work.
Yeah. So would leadership shift in an organization or a new president coming in?
Absolutely. So any shift, a conversation is an ideal way of creating an understanding and moving towards decisions on that shift. If you reflect on your favorite conversations, and every single time I gather with a group, I ask them to reflect on their favorite conversations. We don't analyze it. I just at the very beginning, I just say to them, think about your favorite conversations, and whatever you would do in your favorite conversations, please do that here. Well, when we reflect on our favorite conversations, I suspect that as often as not, probably, and for many people, probably most of the time, there is a kind of a culture of openness in their favorite conversations. There's a culture of curiosity in people's favorite conversations. And in tasks like a shift in leadership, a new president coming in order to find where we are and think about what are the steps that we need to take today and tomorrow to prepare for the change that is upon us. Well, openness and curiosity are, plus all of our skills and knowledge, are good things to bring with us.
It must scare the heck out of some leaders. I would think, I would imagine a pushback that you would get from time to time would be, wow, Rick, you can't go here. Like, I'm happy to have this kitchen table conversation, but we're going to have to set some ground rules for you as the facilitator, as the leader.
You're right. And one of the things that I've learned over the years is that in an environment where there is not much context, I don't need to prepare in advance of a conversation. In an environment, the higher the context of the situation, the more carefully I have to prepare. So what do I mean by context? Well, is it a working organization where there's history, where there are issues, where there are conflicts, where there are people with more power than others, where there are issues that people have been wrestling with for a long time and have made no progress, where there are competitors who are breathing down their neck, and those of us who are asked to come in and lead a conversation, if it's an important conversation, if there's a lot riding on the conversation, then we need to prepare very, very carefully. And there are situations where somebody will say to me, here's the question we want to discuss, will you come and join us next Thursday? And I go, oh, that's a great question, let's go. And there are other situations, and let's say that conversation is 2 hours long. There are other situations where somebody asks me to come for a two-hour conversation, and I prepare full time for 2 weeks for that two-hour conversation so that I know as much of the context as I possibly can in order to, because there's so much riding on the conversation that I need to be as sure-footed as I can be. And the people in the room want to know that they don't have to teach me. They want to know that I can serve them effectively as opposed to them having to slow things down while I figure out what the heck is going on.
So it's fascinating. I'd love to talk more about some of that prep and the time that you probably do have to put into it. And I would imagine fees are structured accordingly if you're spending several weeks of time prepping for a two-hour conversation.
That's right.
You know, that's right. You charge how much for a two-hour conversation, right?
Right.
I can imagine getting that kind of feedback as well, or pushback. Don't good conversations, to some degree, and you and I don't know each other well at all, and I think we're having a pretty good conversation already.
Feels like that to me.
Right? Yeah. Don't the most great conversations presuppose a certain amount of trust? And maybe you and I have that already because of that short time that we spent. Maybe it's about demeanor. Maybe it's about intuition. Maybe there's something else going on there.
So I have a confession to make. All these years later, a lifetime later, because as I said, like from being a toddler, our home was a home where there was always a good rambunctious conversation going on. And I don't want to make us sound like the Waltons. We had as much going on in our house as anybody else. Little House in the Prairie.
We just dated ourselves, by the way, in a huge way.
I'm sorry. My apologies to the world.
Right. Yes.
A lifetime of conversation. And ironically, I don't feel that I'm an expert on the role of trust in conversation. But here are a few things that I can say. One is that as soon as one person in the conversation starts to demonstrate curiosity and appreciation of the other people in the conversation, then that starts to change the conversation for the better. Just all it takes is one person at the table. Now, if there is somebody at the table who is demonstrating the opposite of those things and shows no and has power and shows it has been found by researchers that one way to take power in a conversation is to just talk more. And so if that person has nobody to bring them back into the middle, then, in fact, you're not going to have a conversation. In an environment where there isn't a facilitator, there is never going to be a conversation when that person is dominating. When a facilitator comes into the mix, relatively easily, most of the time, the facilitator can be helpful to the over-dominant person and help them return to a more collaborative approach.
Is that one of the classic examples of shutting down a conversation, one person dominated?
The
structure, the ego, et cetera?
And my response to that one has to be a bit weird. I guess so, but thankfully I don't experience it. And I suspect that that's true of most facilitators, that if you are trained and do your job, then nobody's going to dominate. So it's only once in a while somebody tries to dominate and I cheerfully and respectfully help them stop dominating. And notice my choice of words. I sometimes, because I like a rambunctious conversation, years ago there were times when I'd say, "You be quiet." And it's not that I think it's wrong to say you be quiet, because I want everybody around the table to know we're having a rambunctious conversation. Even when I'm saying you be quiet, I'm trying to do it in a way that lets them know I think they're a great person and I want to hear what they have to say. But at this particular moment, you be quiet. I've found, as I've gained more experience, that I have to do less and less and less.
I'm sure.
To keep the conversation that we all want. Yes, once in a very blue moon, there will be a person at the table who just doesn't get it and is just not prepared to have a conversation with the other people at the table.
I mean, I teach, and it happened. I'm sure it happens a lot in academic environments, but a lot of the conferences I used to go to years ago, philosophy conferences in particular, you would get, you know, somebody had just given a 40-minute talk, usually a paper that they've read, not really a talk. Mm-hmm. They've just read their paper. And then they'd open it to Q&A. And then you'd often be a facilitator. And I'll never forget this one time. And I can't remember the academic's name right now, University of Guelph. And a person asks a question in the room, maybe 40 people in the room. So it's a small, intimate, pretty intimate setting, really. Mm-hmm. You would think that would lend itself to a pretty good conversation and dialogue after an event like that. Philosophers, for heaven's sakes. And so the person got the floor, and this happened a lot, and the microphone, and chose it as an opportunity to pontificate and to preach, basically. And then finally, it wasn't even the facilitator, the person who'd given the paper. Is there a question here? Whoa.
That's hilarious.
So it kind of shut the whole room down a little bit, because now she's tipped her hand a little bit that she's a little confrontational. She couldn't have handled that a little better, maybe. And the facilitator just bailed.
Well, and,
this person and dominated, wanted a platform. You know?
And it sounds like that in that unfortunate situation, the facilitator was just inexperienced.
Yes.
And yes, you can be trained when you take a course in facilitation. I'm sure that. And by the way, I'm self-taught, and so I can't swear that these things are handled in a course on facilitation, but I can't imagine that they're not because it's a big issue.
It's a huge issue.
And what the trainer would undoubtedly say is, here's what you do. Oh, and by the way, you're going to find that with practice, this is going to get easier. Facilitation is like surgery. I mean, it doesn't have the life and death consequences of surgery, but what it has
it
in common,
over time.
Maybe it will. But what it has in common with surgery is that it takes a lot of practice. Mm. Nobody in the world has ever been with a surgeon when she was doing a procedure for the first time. When a patient has a very serious procedure and they're sitting in the surgeon's office, the surgeon is always asked the question, so you've been doing this a long time. And the surgeon always said, oh, yes, I've done this hundreds of times. And it's true, because even a surgeon who is sitting with a patient for the very first time has been training for a decade before they had the opportunity to sit with the patient for the very first time. Now, because facilitation does not rank in the same level of difficulty or the same level of risk or the same level of importance to society as surgery, it's not the same kind of rigorous preparation. But facilitators who have been in the room enough times are going to know what to do when that person gets out of hand.
I love the fact that you brought up a surgical technique. I want to talk about something that I think you referred to in a paper that you wrote a while back about the kitchen table conversations, tacit knowledge you talk about. And I think there's probably, depending on the environment that you walk into, there's hundreds of years of tacit knowledge that's being brought to this conversation. And somehow you've got to validate that, it seems to me. And maybe that's kind of what you were talking about when you said, you know, people typically, once somebody shows a curiosity or an openness or affirms the other and says, wow, that's a great point. I mean, maybe there's a little bit of reductionism going on here.
No, you're absolutely right.
It opens the room up.
Right.
It becomes more, there's the fellowship of the ring.
There
right?
is.
There's a camaraderie, there's a conviviality, right? Of a community.
And so yes to everything you said. And I'm sure that happens in any productive meeting. It's that distinction between water with sand in it and water that's been filtered, so it's a pure water. By inviting people to have I've talked about it being a rambunctious conversation.
Yes.
The weird thing about conversation is that we don't want a conversation which is too sterile. We want a roughness to our conversation. I think I can say that many of us really want a rambunctiousness, a riskiness to our conversation, and we can have one which is open and respectful and risky and rambunctious. And why? Because in our real lives we have lots and lots of experience of being both respectful of each other, and rambunctious when we're in the conversation, and we're good at conversation. Let's take a metaphor from the playground. That whatever it is we did with the kids on the playground, it was something we did over and over and over and over and over and over and over again because we loved it so much. Well, imagine that somebody would say to you, "Hey, you know this thing that you folks do on the playground? We can actually turn that into a tool. Would you like to do that?" Who wouldn't want to do that?
I think it's wonderful. The playground analogy, because I think you're absolutely right. I've got an 8 and 10 year old. Spencer and Victoria, the things they're teaching me, or reteaching me, I suppose, reminding me of, I think is, and I think that's what a great workshop does. You know, I hear a lot of people who go to workshops and lectures and who are, you know, professionals, and they're, I've heard that before. Well, yes, but maybe you didn't indwell it before in the way that maybe you could have if you'd been a little more open. Yes, the exercises were the same, or, you know, they had the same book references, but there's, you know, I mean, Diane Ackerman said in The Natural History of Senses, the purpose of art is to shine light in the darkness.
Beautiful.
Isn't that what great conversation's about?
Yes.
Isn't that what a great play is about as
yes.
a former director? Isn't
yes.
that what a great workshop's about?
Yes.
And maybe it's just a little bit of light, right?
Well,
and I love the playground, because if I go back to play, I'm getting a shiver. I go back to playground, I go marvelous, warm, fun, camaraderie, you know, all those things. But don't we kind of, Rick, don't we kind of lose that somewhere along the way? This
we don't know, the education of our youth. David, we don't lose it. We park it. Yeah, and the reason we park it is because nobody invites us to bring it in with us. And so that's why my job is so friggin' easy. Because I got lucky. I didn't have a body of theory which led me to the kitchen table conversation. I just got lucky. And if I can give myself any kind of a pat on the back, it's that the day I got lucky, I noticed it.
You recognized it for some reason. Was there a moment? Was it an epiphany of some kind?
It was a three-part epiphany. The part one was to be in a meeting being run by a colleague and thinking it was the best meeting ever. Part two was but then not giving it another thought. Part two was 6 months later, I had a challenge, and I thought to myself, okay, I've made this promise. How am I going to do it? Oh, I know what I'll do. I'll do what Doug did. Doug Bowie, a wonderful facilitator. I'll do what Doug did that day. By the way, I've checked with Doug years later, and he has no recollection what he did
that day. Tacit. We're back to the
back to Tacit. Thing, right? He's just a master facilitator. He knew where he was. He knew who was with him, and he said, okay, let's have our conversation. Let's do this. And it was amazing. And then I didn't give it another thought until 6 months later. I have a challenge. Right, I'll do what Doug did. I did what Doug did, and it was the best meeting I had ever done. And you remember that.
Yes.
And then another 6 months later, I had an opportunity, and I said to my colleague, well, there's this thing I did once, and it seemed to go pretty well, so why don't we try it? And once again, it was amazing. And that's when the epiphany came. That was point three along. I had 3 points. I had a line. And I knew that I knew it was reliable. I knew it was powerful, valid as an approach. And I thought that the world would beat a path to my door the very next day, and I was completely wrong. Because I had missed the bit about the surgeon's experience. The world, the conversation 20 years later, and it's more than 20 years later. 20 years later, I hope that my conversations are a bit more elegant and a bit more fruitful than they were at the beginning. But they're not that much different. Hmm. What's different is that, as we were saying before, I now have the experience that the outlier events, the black swans, the things, the unexpected, I now have enough experience that when they come along, I'm ready for them. Even if I've never seen them before, I've seen enough that I can handle the strangest oddity that can come up in a conversation. And that's what clients were waiting for, and they were right. It is a very, very rare client who wants to use something which is unproven. Why would they? They have options that are better.
Can we go down that road just a little bit? And maybe, sadly, we're going to have to wrap up really soon. But the proven, your word that you just used. Don't corporate folks, sorry for the label, don't business people, I guess, tend to want numbers.
They
don't
do.
They want charts. Don't they? Aren't they? Isn't there an expectation of a incomprehensible PowerPoint slide that they need to, reread and reread and then file and never go back to again? So they're not expecting conversation. I would imagine I'm hearing pushback saying, yeah, well, Rick, this is great, but it's soft. It's soft skills. They're not hard. They're not hard skills. We can't really quantify this. And, I work in development, and so we use often to raise money what's called a log frame. And it's you can't get much more anti-relational. But if we took a conversational approach, a community-like approach to building one, well, that's where the real work has happened. And then you take all your findings, you put them into this chart, and Rick, that's exactly what it is, a chart, and then you hand it to a donor and you say, hey, this is what we're going to do, right? And there's a bit of a disconnect there, and yet the donor says this piece of paper, okay, I get that, right? Because it's quantifiable now, right? And in a sense, it's a bit of an illusion, and yet it sounds like you've been able to break that wall down. Maybe not in every case, obviously, because there's lots of clients out there that you probably haven't worked for yet, but...
Well, heck, if I've done it over 1,000 times, there are hundreds of thousands of clients I haven't worked with yet, or hundreds of thousands of situations where I haven't worked in yet. I know for a fact that not everyone who has come to my table thought it was a good idea. Thankfully, I'm proud to say that two of the people who have told me that their first impressions were negative, when they took a second look, did a complete turnaround and realized that there was not just more there than they thought, but something that they wanted to embrace. Because on a closer look, they did realize that there were things that you can do in a conversation that you cannot do in a meeting. Yes, there are people who are happy with the way things are. I would say that any leader has a right to know that what we're bringing in is reliable, and also not reliable in the sense that it's going to behave the same way every time it's used, and that's essential. But there's a second thing that leader has a right to know, and that is that the work we're going to do is going to make a real difference,
right,
and a bigger difference than the alternative.
Impact.
It's going to have an impact, and that they're going to get that they're going to have a bigger impact working with us than they would if they were to use the other methods available. And so when you're doing something which is outside the mainstream, that's a factor every single time the phone rings. The phone rings because the tried and true didn't work. And when the tried and true doesn't work, then people become open to trying something new. I'm going to tie this to a different dimension of conversation, but there's a really important link. Conversation is a deeply creative process. Mm. And if you have a problem, that means that you require a creative process, because that is the only route to solution. Creativity is the only way to get to solution. And so, given that the essential nature of conversation is creativity, given that some people have problems that they haven't been able to solve other ways, that's when we get called. Or that's one of the situations in which we get called.
Have you ever, it doesn't sound like it to me, and I want to hear a bit more about your business and just as we wrap up, but have you ever really come up against a brick wall?
Yes, there's a self-sorting mechanism that goes on. the people who call have a vision that there is a solution to this problem if they approach it in the right way, most of the time. But once in a while, you get into a situation and you find out that they are really, really stuck.
Mm.
Fortunately, there are other toolkits.
Sure.
And as a consultant, I've been at it long enough that I've got experience in some other toolkits. And one of those toolkits, it's actually an approach to psychotherapy called solution focus. There's a great Wikipedia page on solution focus that gives you a brief but strong illustration of description of how it works, and it is the least mumbo jumbo of therapeutic approaches.
It is
a very meat and potatoes, commonsensical approach to therapy. I am not a therapist; I'm a consultant, but I realized years ago that this real meat and potatoes approach to therapy had some philosophies and some principles and tools that would be valuable to me as a consultant, and especially when people are completely stuck.
You know, Rick, and maybe this is kind of a comedic and yet hopefully insightful way to wrap this up before we hear a little bit more about you and your work. I've been through enough therapy to know that I think great therapeutic sessions are really just good conversations.
Well,
capital G.
Well, in fact, David, that's how I turned to research on therapy. In the beginning of my work in conversation, I wanted to learn more about it, and everywhere I turned, I found nothing. And really, in desperation, it occurred to me, well, therapy is a form of conversation. Mm-hmm. I guess I should read about therapy. Mm-hmm. And that proved to be true.
And now we're talking about trust. Friendship, community, give and take, affirmation, encouragement—all. I mean, maybe criticism as well, but in a friendly, like as you say, polite kind of way. Rambunctious, right? Mm. But still healthy and ultimately deeply relational.
And let me role play that.
Yeah.
How that respect and rambunctiousness play together. You can say to somebody, you know, I completely disagree with you. But I hope that my tone of voice conveyed that I like you.
Yeah.
I think you're great, but at this moment, I just don't get it. I don't get where you're going with this.
I don't, yeah.
You can and when you encourage people to behave that way,
yes,
there is more heart attached to the information that they bring into the conversation.
Yeah, it sounds like we need you to be starting to work with politicians around the world. I think
that'd be fun.
Honestly, I watch some politicians, many, most, if not all. Mm-hmm. Sorry for the sweeping generalization. If these guys would just, and women, would just be a little more open and honest and transparent and then stop scripting everything and be so afraid, you know, of saying the wrong thing, we could not only lead to greater conversations, but I don't know, at the risk of sounding a little trite, probably get to the root of some pretty significant global issues, it seems to me.
Well, I hope you're right, and so let's do it. Let's do it starting this afternoon. But I can say that anybody who aspires to be a better leader would be making good use of their time if they set out to be a better conversationalist. In the very act of engaging in a real conversation, at every moment you are learning how to engage in real conversation, you will also be learning how to be a better leader. Because you will be learning about trust. You will be learning about openness. You will be learning about curiosity. You will be learning about role modeling, what it is you want of others. And on and on and on and on. It's a terrific natural school of leadership.
So I'm looking already forward to part two of this conversation with you. Tell us a little bit about where we can find out more about you, and I hope the book that you're writing.
My co-writer...
you are writing a book.
Nice. In fact, I am. My co-writer, Lisa Frances Jennings, and I have a chapter in a book called Complexity Unraveled. It's available at Amazon, so that's Complexity Unraveled. Available at Amazon. We are not listed as the authors, but Lisa is one of the editors of the book, Lisa Frances Jennings. We have a chapter in that book on the kitchen table conversation as a process. And also, Lisa and I are at work at developing a longer piece that goes into a lot of detail about how to use this approach in your work. We hope to have it ready to share with the world within a few months.
And if I want to hire you, where do I go?
My website is poststone.com. Or you can just find me on LinkedIn. My name is Rick Wolf, and there's an E on Wolf.
And there's an E on Wolf. Thanks so much for joining us today. I really appreciated the conversation.
My great pleasure.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.